Hi, this is Ryan Nagy. Welcome to podcasts revolving around the work of Dr. Moshe Feldenkrais. Today we have the first of what should be three podcasts with Mia Segal, Lior Gaster, and occasionally Danielle Pulvis, all from the Mind-Body Studies Center, which conducts trainings all over the world from Europe to South America, Asia, and very soon in the United States. For those of you who do not know, Mia Segal was a friend, student, and collaborator with Moshe beginning in 1957. Mia conducts trainings with her daughter, Lior Gaster. And over the next several podcasts, they share some wonderful stories about Moshe, about themselves, and about their trainings and training philosophy. This first podcast is about 30 minutes long, and Mia and Lior answer many, many of my questions about their history, relationship with Moshe, what it was like to have Moshe around the house, as well as the various trainings that some of you may be familiar with. The Tel Aviv training, the San Francisco and Amherst trainings, Mia's training with Moshe, as well as her own trainings in Holland and Switzerland that were approved by Moshe and began while he was still alive. This interview started about 30 minutes after I met Mia at Lior's home in Austin, Texas. I sat down, and before I knew it, Mia was telling me some wonderful stories, so I had to stop, quickly get out my recording equipment, and start recording before I lost any of them. So you'll hear me starting this podcast with me asking Mia to repeat what she had told me just a few minutes earlier. Enjoy. So we were talking about the training and a little bit of history.
A little bit of history of you asked me about the trainings you gave in America.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had two trainings in America. One was in San Francisco, and then the next one was in Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
The San Francisco one was for 3 years. When it finished on the fourth year, I went there to give it as if a continuation with Dr. Bracha, who was a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
That took part in the training that Moshe gave in Tel Aviv for 13 people.
Ah, I don't know that name. What, Dr. Bracha?
Bracha?
Uh-huh. What's his first name?
Shlomo.
Okay.
Shlomo Bracha.
There was a different Shlomo in the 13.
Okay. So he wasn't one of the 13?
He was. He was.
Uh-huh.
He was. And he was a very well-known neurologist in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think it was an honor to have him in that group.
Mm.
But Moshe was asked by the guild to come for a fourth year, and he said, I'm not going this year, will you go there? And I went with Dr. Bracha together, I invited him to come also, and we gave them the fourth year, which was the fourth summer, where I did the Feldenkrais part of it, and
yes.
Shlomo did the explanations neurologically to what we did, and it's got a written verbatim that they are selling, they used to sell in Feldenkrais resources.
Yeah. Did you have people assisting you?
No, just me and Shlomo.
Uh-huh.
So we did that.
And I'm sorry again, this was the fourth year of?
Of San Francisco.
Okay.
That was after they graduated, they had an additional, summer. Mm. Then we had, you wanted to ask about the guild.
Yes.
So during the time that Moshe and I were in San Francisco, two guys, Dub Lee and Mike Joyce, came and told me that they were going to establish a guild. And I went to Moshe and asked him, what's a guild? And he explained to me, and I said, do you mind? And he said, not at all, let it go. And I think that's how the guild started.
Mm.
Then the next training was in Amherst.
Uh-huh.
The next training was in Amherst. And that was supposed to be 4 years. But after 2 years, Moshe got ill.
Right, remember that.
And the ones to continue the third year and the fourth year were people who he chose from the training that he gave in Israel to the 13 people that he taught while we were in Japan, and myself. What else can I tell you about the... I wanted to say just that during the time that we were in the San Francisco training, Moshe's all-time friend, Franz Wurm, who actually established the Feldenkrais ideas in Switzerland, organized a training for me in Zurich.
Like a practitioner training? You're going to be teaching other practitioners?
Uh-huh. Yeah, to open it. And this was actually with Moshe's blessing. And he said, okay, when we're not in San Francisco, go and do this for France in Switzerland. And I did an accredited certificate they got after that. So it was an accredited training that I started in Switzerland. And it went on for about 12 years. Because after this training, there was another one and another one. Another thing that happened when I was... It's not true. The first training was when he said, let's go to Holland. He was invited to go to Holland for giving a training to the Psychology Institute, something like that, where the man who owned that institute was Dr. J. Stadtmann. He was American. And he started some, what did he call it? Body therapy training, some kind of something like that. And he invited Moshe to give a training. So I went with Moshe for the first session, which was in Rotterdam. And there is the Rotterdam tapes, which are very good.
Ah, someone else told me that I should get... Yeah, Rob actually mentioned that. He said, get the Rotterdam tapes.
They're very good. But then he didn't want to go on further. So during the time that we did San Francisco and Amherst, I was giving those two trainings. I started in Holland, which I only finished about 10 years ago.
They went on for about 20 years. No, the training wasn't 20 years
ago. Right, but multiple trainings.
Yeah,
right.
Multiple trainings in Holland. So he gave me his blessing to give those two trainings in Switzerland and in Holland. And during that time, we also were teaching in America. And indeed, when by the time Moshe passed away, the guild had their program of teaching with the tapes.
Right.
And I had those two trainings going on in Europe. I really wanted to be free and teach my own way, to continue in Switzerland and to continue in Holland. And that's what I did. What I found difficult to... another reason that I found difficult to continue with the guild is because they insisted on their own program.
Right.
Which started with showing the DVDs and explaining.
Right.
And I always thought that I knew what they were teaching and what they learned because I taught them. I was there when they were taught. But they didn't know what they didn't learn, which I know how Moshe... continued afterwards, which he taught me for so many years.
Yeah, at that point, you'd already been working with him for 20 years or something.
By that time, nearly 20 years, yeah. So I couldn't be restricted to this thing. Yeah. And I felt I wanted to go free.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
Wonderful. So why did Moshe, why did he stop, didn't want to continue the Rotterdam training? He pulled out and then you finished
out.
That?
He said, look, if we are traveling to San Francisco... For me to go on traveling and tying myself down to travel to Europe as well, to Holland, three times a year is too much. You want Holland? Take it. And with my blessings.
Great.
And indeed, also during that time, every time I had some questions about how to go on, or how to, what is the best way to teach, or can you give me some help about how to develop it a little further? So he used to help me a lot in this.
Yeah, of course.
And that's how I went on there.
So, and I know a lot of this has been covered already. There's been some interviews with you in Somatics Magazine, etc. But again, since this is going to be widely available to anyone, if it's okay with you, I'd like to cover some of the historical stuff. So, I mean, you began working with Moshe in
57.
And at that time, though, I mean, you were married, you had a couple of kids, you were already an Alexander teacher,
yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You work with Charles Neal,
exactly.
Who I believe My understanding was he worked with Alexander, but then had a split of some sort.
That's right. He worked with Alexander, and then he opened his own institute, which was called the Isabel Cripps Center in London.
In London, okay.
Yeah, and he was a friend of Moshe, and through him I met Moshe.
Okay. And you hadn't been on a path to learn Alexander. Your husband had asthma or something, and you wanted to help
that's
him.
That's how I came to this work.
Okay. And so when you went back to Israel, what was the connection with Moshe? How did you decide to work with him?
No, I didn't. Charles Neal came to visit Moshe in Israel, and of course he came to visit us. And then he brought Moshe to our house, and Moshe said, listen, I'm working all by myself. I've got a lot of people who need me. Charles here says you've got very good hands. How would you like to come and work with me? So that's how I started.
Wonderful. And so you started right away? Did you just, you went over and said, okay, show me what you do, and what happened next?
I came to see what he did. And it was very amazing for me because I never saw such... It wasn't like I saw in Alexander. And I said to him, you know what? Maybe I don't work with you. I'll just watch. And of course I watched, and I've been doing it ever since. And he was such a great teacher. I used to come and sit and watch what he's doing. And every time after a lesson, he'd say, any questions? And I still remember when I said to him, you can't answer my questions now. There's people waiting outside. And he looked at me and said, you know what? If you know what you want to ask, it'll take a minute. And that I remember until today.
Also, you know what you want to ask,
every way,
it'll take a minute.
If people know what they want to ask, it's very short.
You know, usually in the development of this work, we think of, you know, you lie down, you do awareness through movement, and then you learn how to touch. And you did it. You were actually giving
FI.
The
other way around. I started by doing FI because I knew most of it. And he taught me so well that it never was like you start working now. I just one day thought, wow, I'm already working, and I don't remember who I started with.
So who was your first student? You have no idea. Don't remember.
Don't remember. I remember who was his first student. When I walked into that room and saw him working, I remember everything.
Wow. When did you discover there was something, this verbal work, the exercises?
Oh, no. Then he came and said, would you like to come and see what I do? So I'll pick you up on... He used to give workshops on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday evenings, and Friday... during the day in Alexander Yanai.
Okay, it
that's
was Alexander
the place
Yanai.
Where he was teaching. So I came there, and that's where I first saw it. The first time he came to pick me up to see what he's doing, I thought, wow, but he's... Where are his papers? How does he know what to teach? I mean, he's not looking. He's not preparing himself. And we drove, and he's talking all the time, and I'm just worried about... He's not concentrating. He's got to give a class, and he doesn't rehearse it or anything. And then he came, and of course there was an ATM. And I said to him, you didn't prepare anything. And it was amazing to me. How can he do it? And he said, well, I'll tell you something. I actually give the same lesson all the time, except in a different way.
And was he recording during this time?
No, there was no record. When the first time he discovered that there's such a thing as recording, I remember he came to the house and he was so excited and he said, look what I've got. Now I can record it and my voice will be eternal. And he was very, very happy.
Did having the did that change things, having the recording it somehow? Did it change
things? I thought a little bit, maybe at the beginning. The same way as I thought that when he started showing to a lot of people how he does FI, it also changed the dynamica in between him and the person who was lying down. And when I was in the room watching just by myself, even that, I think, was not the same as before I came.
Mm-hmm.
But people got used to it and they accepted it, and he gave fantastic lessons. But when he started showing to more people, the atmosphere changed.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And then at some point, you worked with Moshe for a decade or more.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to Japan for
a
few years?
Yeah. Then we went to Japan for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And it's his fault because he was telling us all about judo and Japan and everything. And we left for 3 years. But towards the end of the 3 years, and then he corresponded and he told me what was going on with the students and
okay, because so you left, and then he started working with the so-called 13,
yes.
Ruthie and Yokanan and
yes.
Hava, that whole group.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then when he finished with them, he came to visit us in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful for him. We took him, we did a lot of Japanese things. Like we did judo, all of us, Leora and I are black belts. And my husband and my son are brown belts.
Mm.
And
which was something at the time. Today it doesn't mean a lot, but at the time it was a big deal.
It's true. It was different. And when Moshe came, we took him to meet all our masters, which were really great masters. And especially in the Kodokan, he was very excited about meeting famous judo people like Mifune and Ozawa, people like this.
Mm. But you know, there was one of your persons, Dr. Noguchi?
Noguchi.
Noguchi. And he said something I thought was... I guess he got an FI from Moshe.
Noguchi is a great student.
Yeah, so you were sort of his student, but more of a collaborator in a sense, or more of a... Yeah, you were...
He was a very famous person in Japan. They still continue his method. Mm-hmm. Is all over the world. He had many followers. I think what he had was like 13,000 people followed him. And he had his own method. And I always, with my correspondence with Moshe, I told him about Noguchi. So, of course, when he came, he wanted to see who he was about him. And then Noguchi was wonderful to him. He invited him for a demonstration with all his students.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you comfortable?
Hmm? No, I'm just adjusting myself so I can focus more on you.
Are you comfortable?
I will be
Are
in just a moment.
Are you breathing at all? Oh, okay. It's better. You want a pillow?
No, I'm good for now. Yeah.
Now you'll feel much better, you see?
Yeah. Okay.
And you are breathing.
Yes, thank you.
Thank God.
So Dr. Noguchi, and he got a session from Moshe.
He got a session from Moshe. No, he watched. Moshe gave a demonstration, and because it's Japanese,
mm-hmm.
there was, of course, a translator, but he took me as the model, like it was the lesson of whatever you'll call it, of turning.
I think we call it the dead bird.
Well,
similar.
I call it Noguchi.
Noguchi, okay.
So, dead bird.
Because with the hand, it's okay.
That's how a bird dies?
Yeah, or something.
A swan lake, that's it.
No.
We'll have to change it, beautiful swan.
It doesn't have two hands, but it can be like this.
No.
It's not written in the Bible.
It is.
Like this.
No, it is that it has to be free here.
Free, but not dead.
Yes. So we were saying, what I heard was Moshe, and correct me because you were there, not me, gave Noguchi a lesson.
No.
Okay.
No, what he demonstrated an ATM.
Uh huh. Okay. There was a quote where he said, "There's no difference between what you and I do, except," and this is Dr. Noguchi speaking. He says, "Except that I give them the food and leave it next to them. Moshe, you feed them and digest them for him," or something.
So that happened after Moshe demonstrated FI on somebody. But he didn't give it to Noguchi. Noguchi was watching, and they were all watching while Moshe gave an FI. That's for sure.
Hmm.
But he did say that.
Yeah. And that thought had an effect on you, or?
No.
No.
Why? I thought it was a very nice thing. It's true, because, you know, Noguchi used to do 7 people in between 15 and 20 minutes.
Mm.
Because he did it very quickly. It was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sent them
mm.
after about 2.5 minutes a person.
And he was focusing on their spine, or he was manipulating their spine mainly?
I know what he did because I exchanged lessons with him. While I was there, I went to all that I could,
mm-hmm.
his meetings with his students and demonstrations. And also, after that, I'd stay there later. They all went home and we'll exchange lessons.
Mm.
So it wasn't only the spine. He actually worked on the whole body, very similar to what we do, but very quickly.
Mm.
Very quickly. And he used to speak about moving the energy in the body. With his, yeah.
Mm.
And he was very effective. There were people who really felt that he did wonderful things.
Right.
He also had a way of doing a group things and verbally guiding them into movements.
Hmm. But they would each do their own unique thing somehow.
Each would do their own unique things. And I watched them do it in an amphitheater, like 4,000, between 4,000 and 6,000 people doing it together.
Hmm.
It was very amazing.
During this time, the 13, they had their training.
Yeah.
And it was during the 3 years that you were in...
Japan. And then we returned to Israel.
Uh-huh.
And very shortly after that, we were invited to San Francisco by Tom Hanna.
For the San Francisco training, just like that.
Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, yeah.
So, 72, came back, worked with Moshe, and then the San Francisco training started. What was it like when you first met the 13, some of those people, Ruthie and Yochanan?
Well, I knew them before because they used to come, when I was there, they used to also come to Alexander and I.
Mm-hmm.
So they were not new to me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
How do you think their training or interactions with Moshe were different than yours?
I think it was different in the way that they were a bigger group.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told you, I feel that the dynamics in the watching FI, the dynamics is different when he had just himself with somebody
mm-hmm.
or when there were many people in the room. So, and also, I think that with them, he already probably had the program in his mind, what you teach first and second and third. And with me, it was much more spontaneous in a way. And as Leora says now, that it was part of our life in the house.
Right.
And he used to integrate it whenever he felt like it. Come and see, there's a foot, and he'd take Leora's foot and show how the toes are moving.
Mm-hmm.
And Leon's friend will come and he'll say, what? This problem with basketball. Let's show it another way of throwing a ball into the basket and so on. So it was different in that way.
Yeah, so I guess at this point you had already had 10, 15 years with Moshe. So would he share manuscripts with you? Like, because the Awareness Through Movement book came out in 77.
We did
something.
This together,
yeah.
And all the pictures that you see in the original book
uh-huh.
were on this table that's here.
Huh.
That's where we photographed the
person. And we're in Austin, by the way, not in Israel.
Yeah, it's probably that's the table.
Yeah.
And this carpet, he used to lie on this carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we have.
I can feel it.
I'll throw you a picture of this carpet with Moshe, and we had a dog and puppies. And he's lying there and they're climbing all over him. On this carpet, indeed.
Mm.
So it was, from that point of view, it was different.
I think also it's not that he would only show things in the house, you can say, they can't hear me, but he was experimenting himself. He'd lie down and try stuff. You know,
Yeah, and that there was these things, because we spent many hours on his, usually he'd come and he'd stay for like the whole Shabbat, Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a lot of of talk about the work. Like he'd say, look, if I do this movement, notice what happens here. So what do you feel? And so on. While enduring when somebody else in the house will do other things, you know, it mm-hmm. was unstructured.
Sure. And that first day you worked with Moshe, or you watched, he was working with people on a bed. Is
yes.
that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. And he was experimenting quite a bit back then, right? I remember you hearing something you said, he would try different positions and different props and different...
No, on the contrary. I said that only after we were in America, things started to be invented. They said, Feldenkrais bed has to be so-and-so.
Uh-huh.
A roller has to be so-and-so. Pad has to be so-and-so. Suddenly they became a marketing thing. Mm-hmm. But in his house, he'd take a stick of a broom, and that would be the stick. Or we used to get the rollers that they rolled newspapers on.
Uh-huh.
And we go to the place where they had a newspaper printing place and collect those rollers from the paper.
So you have to use those to do the Feldenkrais method.
There weren't pads, we just took books off the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then we could adjust the height.
And that was better, because he took a book and he'd say, okay, I put that high. Ah, it's too high, you take
it's
a book
a
away.
Book.
Like that.
Great.
That
it's a liberating thing to know. So when did you begin giving... Well, you didn't call it functional integration then. What did you call it? The hands-on work or
we
something?
We were sitting for hours after he wrote that book, Awareness Through Movement.
Yes.
We photographed the whole thing in my house. And then he had to, later on, when he started talking in English, translating it into English and thinking, how shall we call it? So there were discussions whether to call it integration and so on. And then he worked out the word functional integration and awareness through movement.
And when you began giving your own sessions, was there any agreement? Or you just, when did you start seeing people? Did he start referring people to you? Like,
no,
I'm so busy.
I only worked in his place. He'd say, like, today I've got this person for you. Come and do it. So I'd come. But ATMs I didn't give until I started in Holland. That's when he first said to me, when he came there to give the first teaching in Holland, in Rotterdam, it was. And I just came to watch, like I'm always used to watch all his ATMs and have a fantastic time and then lie and do ATM or not. And then he said, would you like to give one? I said, what? He said, an ATM. I said, yeah, thinking he's talking about the far future. And he said, okay, so give. I said, what do you mean? He said, give now. I said, now? No, I can't do it now. He said, yes, you give. And I said, Moshe, I'm scared. I said in Hebrew, I'm scared. And he said, you'll be scared and you give. And next thing it was recorded. That's why I remember it. And next thing you hear, because he fell asleep. And I had to give my first ATM.
And this was in the training in
Rotterdam. And it was a terrible ATM. That was my first one.
Before I came here, I was trying to think of Moshe's teaching as in he somehow went through stages, or there were different phases of his teaching. Teaching other people how to do what he did. And I sort of thought of the first phase as being Mia Segal. Like, okay, I need to teach... How can I teach somebody to do what I do? And then I don't know if stage is the right word, but then several years later, he reached another teaching the original 13 Israelis.
Yeah. No, what I felt that was different is really that because he wrote to me, he said, I've got a group of 13 people, and this day I taught them this. And that day, we've already been lifting a head or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me like it was really structured much more.
Mm.
Because with me, I don't think he ever thought, or maybe he did and I didn't know. when to teach what. It happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the difference. Mm.
Okay, that's all I have for now. We took a break a few minutes after that last sentence to stretch our legs and have some coffee and snacks. And I do have another hour or so of material with Mia and Leora. I will likely post another podcast or two using that material. Okay, catch you next time. Bye-bye.